You know who has suffered a lot over the last year? Our elderly residents. COVID attacks the elderly worse than any other group. You look at the data. If you actually look at the data and the charts, the elderly have come under attack worse than any other group. But it's still not a reason to stop living. It's still not a reason to lock people down. It's still not a reason to leave people alone and lonely. You know the second group that I think's been hit the hardest? Is children. Children have suffered. Children need to go to school, unless they're being homeschooled, which is fine. But for kids that don't have that option, mommy or daddy can't do that, can't afford to do that, they need to be at school. Kids need to have normal childhoods. And what we've seen is a system that has failed them over the last year. And with that in mind, our guest, Naomi Schaefer Riley, is a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum and a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, AEI, which does wonderful work. She wrote a piece in December, Child Welfare Agencies' Rush to Go Woke is Terrible for the Kids. Why, Naomi? First, tell me about the rush to go woke and why that's bad for the kids.
Well, so as with so much of our discussions about cultural and political issues these days, the roots of this are, of course, found in racial disparities. And so the conversation about child welfare right now is almost all about race and all about racial disparities. And people have noted that we remove children who are African American from their homes and put them in foster care at a rate that's significantly higher than we remove white children. And this is supposedly evidence of racism. Unfortunately, as with all discussions about racial disparities, there's rarely a deeper sense of what else we need to think about. And so the first thing that we need to think about is the fact that African-American children are suffering abuse and neglect in this country at about twice the rate of their white counterparts. So, one answer to that is, okay, we could just look the other way and make sure that our Excel spreadsheet columns come out even, because that's the most important thing. Or we can actually basically follow policies that make us help the kids who are most vulnerable and who are suffering the most. And sometimes that means removing them from their home. Sometimes that means other things too. But the idea that we just are simply not going to respond to the kids who are suffering this abuse and neglect because of their skin color, I think is pretty outrageous.
So you're saying that if a child is in a bad situation, that child welfare advocates and professionals are now less likely to remove them because that might be perceived as racism?
Yes, they absolutely are looking at a child's skin color before making a determination about whether to put that child in foster care. And then even later on, if that child finds that they cannot go back to their biological home because it is too dangerous or their parents are incapacitated, then the child welfare system is going out of its way to try to match that child for the purposes of adoption with somebody who shares that child's skin color. That is, by the way, illegal according to federal law, but skin color seems to be trumping all else in the child welfare system, the same way it is in many of our old other arenas these days.
When you say that that runs afoul of federal law, I don't know what the federal law on that matter is. Is it that it would be racially blind? I mean, what is the statute or what
yeah,
does that look like?
There was a law passed in the mid-90s called the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act, which says that states, and by the way, it is states who are in charge of child welfare policy generally, states may not discriminate based on race or ethnicity when placing a child for foster care or adoption.
So there are consequences to this viewing everything through a racial lens. And it just seems that so many times the people who suffer from black activists, black professors, black media, black race hustlers, it seems like the sorts of things they're promoting, and black politicians, should I say, and white liberals, end up falling hardest on the poorest minorities. And here's one of those cases that is probably not going to get enough publicity. But imagine a child who needs to be removed from an environment. You know, I can't remember which, if it's Netflix or Amazon Prime, but there's a story about a little boy named Gabriel. And
yeah.
He was in a terribly abusive relationship, was ended up mm-hmm. beaten to death, and why they didn't get him out of there when the telltale signs were there for over a year. And it sounds like this was part of that, that there was a fear of being accused of racism. We should be protecting a child at the expense of all else and be willing to fade the heat for anyone who criticizes based on race or anything else.
I think we absolutely should. And unfortunately, you know, that's not the case. And I think, you know, so many of these ideas about racial disparities have infected the child welfare system. And so you even get, you know, I was one area where this is going on is New Orleans. There's a judge in New Orleans who is specifically trying in her decisions in family court to try to rectify racial disparities. So she's basically said she takes race into consideration. She's much more reluctant to remove black children from their home. And the state authorities, the state child welfare department is well aware of this. One authority there in Louisiana told me, quote, race is absolutely something that impacts the judge's decision making. She makes no bones about that. And so, you know, from my perspective, you know, this is a flagrant violation of the law, but it also suggests that we are much more concerned with race than we are with the actual well-being of individual children. And that is not what the child welfare system is set up to do. Similarly, you're getting entire policies. The state of New Jersey has basically, I think, instituted a policy in favor of what they call kinship care in order to make sure that more kids stay with families who look like them. Even if that means their extended family might not be equipped to care for them, as we know, dysfunction in immediate nuclear families, you know, doesn't often come there magically. There's often, you know, dysfunction in the extended family as well. And so you get a situation where not only are kids, you know, placed in homes where, you know, they still have access to the parents who were abusing them or neglecting them in the first place because they're with extended family, but often in New Jersey's policy, for instance, is called, you know, kinship diversion. And what kinship diversion means is basically, you know, a child welfare worker will go into a home, determine that a child is probably in some danger, encourage that child's parents to sort of put them someplace else, and then not even make a record of it or check up on the child after the fact. So the idea is, like, we're just going to sort of sweep these kids under the rug. We're not going to keep track of them. We're not even going to make a note in our records that this was an issue. And all of this is in the service, I think, of, you know, ensuring that the racial numbers come out evenly.
You closed your piece with the very powerful line, "We would rather listen to the screams of abused children than subject a woman to some imagined instance of racism. Child welfare has lost its way." The only problem is, I think the reality is worse than that. We're not actually listening to the screams of abused children if they're black or brown. We're refusing to even listen to those screams because they don't get to scream. This happens behind closed doors. But your point is well taken. Rather than subject a woman to some imagined instance of racism, guess what? Even black and brown women or men don't get to abuse their children. We won't allow it to happen. That should be the we should feel comfortable saying that.
Yeah, absolutely. And this that last line was actually a reference to an advice column that appeared in the New York Times Magazine, where someone literally wrote into the advice columnist, the ethicist, and said, "I'm hearing my neighbor's children scream. You know, they're clearly being whacked. I hear this on a regular basis. And I don't want to call the authorities because I fear that, you know, a police interaction with this woman will end badly." And so literally you have this neighbor who is so worried about, you know, what will happen to this woman that she has forgotten that there are actual, you know, actual victims in real time down the hall from her that she's not doing anything about. And I think, you know, the media narrative obviously has taken hold in this woman's mind to the point that, you know, she has completely forgotten about, you know, what it means that there are children down the hall being abused. And so I worry that this is what is going on here with our, you know, it's kind of a microcosm of our entire foster care system. You have a whole movement now in favor of abolishing foster care that's sort of running parallel to the abolish the police movement. And there are a lot of similarities. You abolish the police, the people who are going to be most affected are poor black people who need the protection of law enforcement from crime in their neighborhood. And similarly, if you go abolish foster care, the people who are going to be most suffering are poor black and brown children who need the help of the state and authorities in order to get protection from the people who are abusing them. And there's just no sense of anything beyond these numbers don't look right, and that's the most important thing to us.
This is such a delicate balance because I've seen cases where I think in Texas CPS was too aggressive in pulling kids out without regard to race. And it's one of those things that, you know, it's a case by case. It's an ugly situation. What matters most is the welfare of the child, but there is a protection of the parents, and a lot of things go into balancing this. But I read this paragraph, and it disturbs me. In New Jersey, the number of kids in foster care plummeted to 4,500 from about 7,500 between 2014 and 2019. But racial equity seems to be at the top of the agenda for the Department of Children and Families at a time that the state was racked by drug overdoses. I've had so many friends and listeners who are foster care families, and they talk about bringing a child into their home who has been, from the time they came into this world, they were addicted themselves to various dangerous drugs. They were exposed to horrible environments. The mother is in all sorts of trouble. The father's not to be found. And I think, how many of those cases are not being referred out? And then I'll let you speak, but your next paragraph: the department has placed thousands of children in the care of relatives and all but closed down recruitment of non-relative foster families. Many of these relatives don't have to pass the same background checks as foster families do, and the department doesn't keep tabs on the kids afterward the way it does with foster families. If somebody gets into the foster care business, they're typically able to provide and willing to provide, whereas a family member might be suffering some of the same problems as the mother, and the real loser here is that child.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the first thing that you noted from what you hear from your friends who are engaged in foster care is absolutely true. It is very hard to find a single case, frankly, of child abuse or neglect where a child has been removed that does not involve substance abuse. There are officials I talk to say probably upwards of 80% of the cases of children being removed to foster care in this country involve substance abuse, and that is not something that we have truly come to terms with. People think, oh, we're just removing kids because, you know, they didn't wear a proper coat to school, or, you know, they don't have enough food in their refrigerator, and if we just give their parents more money or food stamps or, you know, or better clothes or things like that, this is a problem that's going to be solved. It's not, because often the parents are truly incapacitated and can't seek the help for their children and their family that they need. So I think that's the first thing to keep in mind. And the second thing to keep in mind is that these kids, often it's the youngest kids who are suffering the most when a parent is engaged in substance abuse, because they can't take care of themselves. You have, you know, a child under the age of 3, that's where most of the maltreatment deaths happen in this country. It's not, you know, someone who's fighting back or someone who understands, you know, even what's going on. You're talking about kids who are, you know, being left alone for long periods of time while a parent is actually seeking out a drug fix, where you're talking about situations where there's not heat in the house because a parent is too high to understand what's going on, a child who, you know, drowns in a bathtub because no one is actually paying attention to them. Those are the kinds of situations that we're talking about here, and I think that there is really kind of a total misunderstanding of what's driving our child welfare problems. But we can't simply sort of adhere to our theories about how child welfare should look. We need to actually look at what the situation of the kids on the ground is.
I could not agree more. Naomi Schaefer Riley, the piece is posted at our website at michaelberryshow.com. Come back and talk to us anytime. Thank you.
Thank you.